spoken word.
A taste of Melbourne's diverse poetry scene.
Poets using their voices to entertain, to move, to take you on a journey.
Connecting you to grassroots poetry and performance.
Good morning, I'm Tina Janukas. Welcome to Spoken Word on 3CR. 3CR broadcasts from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to elders past and present. Today on the show, I have writer, poet and scholar Marion May Campbell. She has published 4 novels, an experimental memoir, a scholarly work, and 3 collections of poetry, including the cross-genre collection Fragments from a Paper Witch in 2008 and the poetry collections Third Body with Whitmore Press in 2018 and Languish with Upswell in 2022. I should add that Marion is well known to many poets and writers because she taught creative writing for many, many years, both here in Melbourne and in Western Australia. Today, I will be talking with Marion about her poetry. Welcome to the show, Marion.
Thank you very much, Tina.
Over 5 decades of writing, beginning with your novel Lines of Flight, published in 1985, your writing has exemplified a feminist reshaping of language. Now, that's really evident in the cross-genre work Fragments from a Paper Witch. Now, as I read that collection, both when it was published and now again in preparation for this interview, I was once again struck by a political as well as a linguistic project of asserting a feminist project where the feminine subject as less than the male subject is given agency. You do this especially when you engage with the mythopoetic through Greek myth. And I'm thinking here of your engagement with the Minotaur cycle. I would love to hear the poem from Fragments from a Paper Witch, A is for Ariadne, and talk to us a little bit about this project of asserting a feminist subject.
Thank you very much, Tina. I think that language is a field where one must work to bring, you know, the female subject into a state of agency, the way language is used politically to rob women of agency is very much to the fore of my mind when I'm writing. Ariadne, in the typical tellings of the myth, was a donor to Theseus in enabling him to locate the Minotaur at the heart of Daedalus's labyrinth. Then, according to some versions of the myth, she was dumped on Naxos because Ariadne's sister was preferred to herself.
When we speak of agency, let's try to unpack that a little bit. What are we actually talking about?
We're talking about assuming the subject position of action, but also a position whereby one can act upon the world rather than be acted upon. One breaks out of passivity, which can be murderous for women, and we see this all the time happening with the number of women already murdered by intimate male partners, usually, mostly, even this year. Passivity and being assigned to passivity is murderous, has proven murderous for women. Now, Ariadne herself was dumped. She isn't agent of her dumping. She didn't say, "I quit, Theseus, I've had enough of your heroics." She was dumped and she was consoled then by Dionysus, apparently, who I think he made love to her and then he projected her into stardom by making her part of a constellation.
Let's hear the poem.
So this is A for Ariadne. Ariadne, daughter of Minos, was abandoned on the island of Naxos by Theseus during their voyage to Athens after Theseus had, with her assistance, overcome the Minotaur in Crete. And that was from the Dictionary of Classical Mythology, against which I write my piece. It celebrates the tactile. It celebrates what one also knows through blindness, because a lot of the senses are given low ranking in a lot of patriarchal writing and cultural work. Sight is foregrounded. I'm celebrating also other senses. I finger the shell. It's like an ear the snake visits with prophecies, only revered in retrospect. I finger it again, calling it ammonite, recoiling into being. Am Ariadne now beached in the sway between am not? In the breach between Pasiphae and Phaedra? the Ammonite lisped to me to attend to the wake of the tidal pulse. What poise I have on this lip of history. My endless migrations have brought me here to the antipodes of Naxos, when they would have me fixed in a star. What a career! You see me rocking slightly, but this is my poise. This is my particular emergence. I still drip from the grottos, from the tunneling caverns. I've travelled too far, too slowly in the wings of their theatre, listening for a break, queuing with the other understudies. The plays have been mainly about bankers, soldiers, explorers, and sexual athletes. The only entries I've made so far have been into their dictionaries. I found this one under A for abandonment. Some entry into being. Before I am named, the waves suck at my toes. My itch enjoys the grit of shells. Theseus? Ha! I gave him a break all right, supplied him with his birth string. He can visit my father now. He plays judge down there in Hades. Theseus does without the psychopomp. He has diplomatic immunity. Charon ferried. He clenches the bank card between his teeth. As usual, he has the passport garlanded with visa stamps, the torch, pencil slim in his pocket. The unseen they call obscene, everything offstage, he says. He's mapped it all. He demonstrates it clearly, the torch, its ever-ready batteries pole to pole, peeling back the dark. Still, in dreams, I feel the tiny disc of light inspect my flesh. See, it's okay, there's nothing there, nothing at all, he calls. And the monster? What of it? A minotaur in the hopscotch he played on the threshold of manhood, never letting the cracks get to him. That's why they despise puns. They upset their curricula vitae. I'm not going to be myth-taken, fixed in constellation. They're tidying up jobs afterwards. I'll underpun their purpose, sound the lisp as a way of saying, whisper monstrosities, but I'll come to that later. Minos built a great reputation for just law-making, like Theseus, his son-in-law. And what of his annual conscription of Athenian youth? Oh, that was just to school them in underground tactics. He sent them back enlightened all right, a fact that Athens didn't always have the grace to acknowledge. Father and son-in-law immune to me, troubling their neat speak, wobbling their scales. Theseus folded the map and shouted from the deck, "This is what you wanted. This is a new start I'm giving you, girl. May your vision be well compassed," he laughed. I saw his teeth blaze through the foam. Of course he helped Minos clear his name, minus the minotaur that haunted his reputation, the one his wife Pasiphae visited upon him, mother to energies beyond him. It's true she could at one stage invent new contours for her sensuality. If she was a sculpture, she was an actor too, taking on the pain-filled udder, the moist muzzle and the silky lashes she blinked through to him. He stared in steady horror. I gave Theseus his birth spring, so he could shut them up about the mystery. What he found, and if he slayed, he didn't have to tell. He let the rumours elaborate his story. There was a kind of murder. What he overcame was the idea of a boy left behind this kind of initiation. Only a boy fingering the tunnelling bas-relief he sculptured through his adolescence. A boy who heard nothing of just heroes, who swam in the undercurrents, his flesh water-withered. On his reappearance, Theseus let the crowd applaud. He simply held up his sword, the fake blood clotting. Did they even speak? There was a terrible certainty in his eyes, as if nothing would elude his torch now. In the boat afterwards, I saw him against the black sail. I saw the sinews knotting in his neck. I watched him pull and flex his fingers systematically, joint after joint. I knew there could be no meeting for our bodies, unless like Pasiphae. I longed for my mother's fingers unthreading my braids. I let the salt wind shred them instead. I cried no. I cried no to the bludgeoning of his loins that night, anchored in the cove at Naxos. That's when he said it. I suppose it runs in the family. Well, if bullying is what you want. I'm not joking, he said. He wasn't. As if giving me the yarn wasn't a come-on, or have you been in another story all along? It was you, you hussy, who came to me and drugged the guards. I remembered a sculpture my mother did of her face, eyeless. She was blowing the pan flute. She was blown and bulging, pucker-stitching like a pickled person. But this was then, in granite. I found the fissures with my fingers. I was sightless in reply. My fingers searched the mouth, but it was fused with the music played. The pipes grew out of it. I found the swelling in her throat, before Minos, way before. I set this huge memory on the beach. Theseus's boat was just a minor flaw on the horizon. I bathed in the shadow to the left of the nose, to the right, the way was parched. Then the sands rippled a confusion, violet swayed with lemon, music liquefied the idea of stone. The head was something they'd never found when they ransacked her studio after the Minotaur.
One of the things that that poem exemplifies is your resistance to the teleological narrative, to the linear storytelling. So in your poetry, we're often thrust into linguistic complexities, references to European writers that intellectually takes us through the trajectory of 20th century experimental poetry. So this deeply intellectual dimension of your poetry, concealed within metaphorical complexity, makes it, for those that are willing to go on that journey with you, a very enriching experience in poetry. Given both your intellectual and creative trajectories, is this a case of attempting to reconcile different drives in you, which is a psychoanalytic project in a way, or an avant-garde project of linguistic experimentation, which becomes about writing?
Tina, that's a brilliant question, which I balk at answering directly, but I really think that when you say reconciling different drives within me, of course there is the death drive, there is the libidinous drive, the drive to pleasure, and the death drive is for me associated with loss of subjecthood, of dissolution of the subject, which is also the case in extreme pleasure. One is dispersed, but even in smaller pleasures, one is preoccupied by the other, and therefore the sense of self dissolves or its contours are eroded. But also the death drive is related to abjection, which is a state where the object and subject become indistinguishable, and extreme abjection is what is often found by the male gaze in the woman's body. And this is why I set up Theseus with his torch, with his speculum. Ha! There's nothing in there. The woman has to be occupied by the real subject to become something. And so I think those tensions towards dissolution, my embrace of, positive embrace of moments of abjection as a new beginning, as a kind of rebirth, also celebrating aspects of that abjection or dissolution as preparatory to forging a new kind of polyvalent subjecthood that isn't just, as you say, intent on getting from A to B, intent on completion, but to celebrate the actual act of production, not the product. Finitude is what capitalism is intent upon, reifying us by reducing us to the act of making a product, consuming a product, so that we become our appliances, our beautiful home and all of that. Here in poetry, it's a matter of exploring what dissolving boundaries can do in terms of encountering intimately the other and celebrating that alterity within oneself.
I'd love to hear at this moment another poem from Fragments from a Paper Witch, Icarus. That's a very interesting poem. One may say the hubris of the male subject, but I think there's a dissolution of the ego in that poem in a very interesting way.
I wanted my Icarus to encounter intimately what he calls the sight lines of the woman, which is his undoing as a masculine subject, but it's a pleasure fall that he encounters. Icarus, it's the pull on the wax I love, loosening the connection, the beating mechanism of his work. Ah, Helios, what precision acupuncture is this, finding these pleasure points of my undoing. So that in reaching up, becoming something beyond mere flight from there to there, I'm so suspended above my fault. Think flight plan, Daedalus said, compass, attitude, altitude, cruise control, and I've seen them all. Phaedra, Ariadne, Pasiphae, dazzled by a radiance they cannot name. It's not sunblaze that I'm pitching for. If only he knew, something beyond the assembly, feathers, wax, bones aerial. Being his bird, I can only will the moment in the binoculars of the girl outside the story where I let his wings detach. And molten, I pour through her sight lines. What a sunset.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, Melbourne's voice of dissent.
Welcome back. I'm Tina Janoukas, and you're listening to Spoken Word on 3CR. I'm speaking with poet, writer, and scholar Marion May Campbell. Now, Marion, we've been exploring the way that your poetic language intensifies a broader creative and intellectual project where it is the site of becoming, of liberation, of agency, but also a challenge to normative gender roles. How do you see the relationship between your poetic expression and normative power, especially in the context of feminist activism? And I'm thinking here, for example, of your play, The Half-Life of Creonite, which is an overtly political play, drawing, of course, on the Antigone story in classical Greek poetics. But I'm also thinking of the way that your poetry seeks to dissolve, or generally your work, the binary male-female, which is also a way of undoing normative power dynamics. So I'm thinking here of some of the poems in your second collection, Third Body, which is a very interesting title, because what is that third body that you're referring to? And particularly in the sequence Incipient Fordune, which seems to me to try to do away with traditional gender identifications. How would you describe poems in Third Body, and particularly what you're doing in that particular sequence?
Thank you very much, Tina, for that summary and placement of Third Body. Third Body is to me like a mediating body between self and other. It can be language itself. Language is the body of language through which one negotiates a connection to the other. One thinks through one's desire. Desire always happening through the language of the poem. But also, what I'm exploring in Incipient Fordune is the relationship between women, between a woman who is reading as well as writing, and another who is reading and writing. So it's a kind of dance of readership. Because these women are separated from one another, the speaker in these poems, the persona, if you like, uses the landscape to try to figure a connection. So one of the poems ends, outside our skins, unspoken. So they're getting out outside their separate molds as socialized people and coming together in a kind of moment of pleasurable connection through language. But also, it's an attempt at writing an eco-poetics which doesn't just represent the landscape, but shows the landscape as subjectively mediating between people, as making new dimensions for those subjects, if you like.
Let's have a poem.
This is from the Incipient Fordune sequence, and it's June Textilis. It's based on what I learnt of snakes, having watched what was like a super highway of snake tracks in the sand dunes, obviously coming down to the cool of the beach in the night. I was fascinated by the gaps between the imprints of the snakes and the eastern brown snake sidewinds. So it kind of does a print of itself, and I've used the idea of impression as a pun. It does a print and sidewinds and interrupts that print, so there are strange gaps. June Textilis. A forensic eye predicts you shift these marks. Even as becoming snake, you lie impressive on this June incline. As pages turn and my attention floats, you lift, sidewind, lift, sidewind, to watch for a mesmerizing time, then whip smart, tongue flick, you decline in venomation. This rococo finesse might be taken for feminine digressiveness, and so, if reading half erases every text, to score these marks is just an endless game of hit and miss. We laugh to see the genus of the eastern brown snake as textilis, thus to arch with merely two, or sew contact points on sand, and with such poise to sidewind, surely is a way of printing distant love without the grind. What seems to slither prints its scales and lifts, so touching, digital, tangential in our dreams might be just as subtle, to leave on page or screen just here and here, exquisite, rare, a contact point. And so, experimentally June textilis, we might just get the drift and sometimes strike.
You know, part of the question of writing poetry is finding the language to say something. I'm thinking here of poets like Adrienne Rich and others who did away with form to explore a feminist identity. And that project has been going on for a very long time now. Mm. I'm just wondering, where do you think we are? Do you think we have an alternative lexicon to express identities beyond the normative ones? Or is that a trap? Is that another way of becoming trapped in hierarchies of power?
I think it is. I'm very wary about identity politics as such because it belongs to representation. If we have a lexicon, a set of, if you like, a set of keystone terms to write our subjectivity into, that identity can become a prison and prevent becoming. So I think it's an open project, it's an ongoing project. One can never say still, but always looking for ways of connecting through the world, through non-human animals, through the landscapes we live in that provide us with life, finding the language and laws other than our own to play with and to grow.
You're both a novelist and a poet, and of course a scholar. But as you've been talking, I've been thinking about whether really that project that you've just been talking about is actually what poetry especially is suited to doing.
Well, I think so. I think it's the playing field of language. It takes us on adventures. When I started writing Lines of Flight, I didn't intend to write a novel. I wanted to write poetry, but it was the imagery that was suggested by the language where I started to explore my own difference from the roles that were prepared for me, a certain kind of female desire, my bisexuality, if you like, my more lesbian aspects, along with, the heterosexual pull, which I also, experienced. It was trying to find an imagery to describe ways of writing back and upsetting the writing that would place me in a certain situation, in a certain passive, consumerist position.
In your most recent collection, Languish, published with Upswell, I think you offer a more resolved poetics, less in terms of form, though these are beautifully structured poems, and in a way that actually might be a more resolved poetics, but I think more in terms of intensity. They're not so much gentler, though I can't think of a better word right now. They're not the red-hot intensity that crashes over us like a wave. They feel more like the beautiful intensities of sunrises and sunsets, of horizons coming into view. But they're also a product, it seems to me, of a lifetime's creative passion with language. How do you see these poems?
I think they are more leisurely. They're often quite digressive, the poems in Languish. I guess Languish, the title, translates a certain sorrowful longing, which is there in a lot of the poems, which are about loss and even falling into a state of inertia, perhaps. But they also charter new beginnings. And I think the collection, it descends to a certain abyss and rises again with a sense of new hope. A lot of the motifs that I've explored through my novels and in other collections are still there, but I try to take them in new directions.
Let's have some poems from Languish.
Okay, well, thank you, Tina. Part of the politics of correction of hierarchy through the way one speaks is suggested by Spanish cows, because the French have a saying, she speaks like a Spanish cow, which means she doesn't speak like the mainstream academic French that the French Academy would prescribe. It also is very snobby about, can be, as in Australia too, about the way foreigners might mispronounce things, but also explains the title of the collection, Languish, Spanish Cows. When she says the French languish, Bretons lose their grip on fishing nets, scavengers toil weak and slow along the low-tide grey beach sands of Normandy, and refugees lie listless in their cardboard shanties under the blazing canicule outside Calais. In the low-rent housing towers of Nanterre, COVID lockdown sends kids crazy. There's no working lift to the seventh floor, and mothers are sorely tempted to hurl themselves down that shortcut. The French languish, she says again. I see them faint and fold on fire escapes. There seems no end to that entropic fade-out as she pours the thesaurus into that ellipsis. They fail, they flag, they ail, deteriorate. The French language, she enunciates, when well spoken, is music to the ear, but not in the mouths of those Marseillais with their charabia, their nasal twang, ong, ong, ong. They speak like Spanish cows, comme des vaches espagnoles. Of course, Marseille is not La France, and mercifully I come from Tours, where the purest French is spoken. I say, bien sûr, ma châtelaine. Thank you, my dear châtelaine, but mind you stock your moat with baby crocs, now that you can do it with global warming and whatnot. That should sort out the nasal twangers and all them Spanish cows. Well, this is another one. It's The Muse of Tarmacadam, and it's written for Morgan, my son, who, to my chagrin, remains a street skater and has been, you know, passionate and inventive, I must say, skater from the age of about 10 or even earlier. Trashmeisters of the urban plot. These street skaters carve, kick, flip and fakey to land their tricks. They rock gothic in brute geometric deserts and throw flamboyant spectres of baroque with outrageous flares of gutter-sniping slang. They crack festive, tripping, road hump, curb, to ollie backtail, step and bench, and shadows huge reflect themselves in frames of zilch, defying grids of corporate tower in ceremonial twists and turns. These orphans of the car park weeds and broken glass strike pleasure incandescent through concrete poetry's literal demolition. Out of scale with arms in slings, they rail slide wrought iron banisters where far below their spotters signal gaps to land between the cars. A miracle of timing or of flight arrested. How like cartoon cats do they reverse trajectory from between these speeding obstacles? Ah, let their mothers mute their fears. A sweeter siren pours her hot mix through these airborne skaters' ears.
Thank you, Marion.
Thank you so much, Tina.
I'm Tina Janoukas, and you've been listening to Spoken Word on 3CR. Today I've been speaking with poet, writer and scholar Marion May Campbell. Apart from her other writings, Marion has published three collections of poetry, including Fragments from a Paper Witch with Salt Publishing, Third Body with Whitmore Press, and Languish, her most recent, with Upswell.